Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Near the end of Werner Herzog's wonderful documentary film on Antarctica, Encounters at the End of the World, he interviews Peter Gorham, a physicist at the University of Hawaii, who is preparing a balloon experiment designed to detect, for the first time, physical evidence of neutrinos. Gorham describes neutrinos this way. The most ridiculous particle you can imagine. They pass through all of the matter around us continuously in a huge blast of particles that does nothing at all. They almost exist in a separate universe, but we can measure them. We can make precision measurements and predictions. They exist, but we can't get our hands on them because they seem to exist in another place. And yet without neutrinos, the beginning of the universe would not have worked. We would not have the matter that we have today because you couldn't create the elements without the neutrinos. They actually determine much of the kinetics of the production of the elements we know, so the universe can't exist without the neutrinos, but they seem to be in their own separate reality, and we are trying to make contact with that universe of neutrinos. It hits me in the gut that there is something here around me, surrounding me, almost like some kind of spirit or God that I can't touch. Neutrinos are primitive particles that underlie and make possible all elements and thus all the matter and energy in the universe. They are paired and oscillate and move at the speed of light. They lack any electric charge. They pass through ordinary matter. 50 trillion pass through the human body every second. They have non-zero mass, and each is paired with an antineutrino made of antimatter. Gorham describes his project as like measuring the spirit world. Neutrinos seem a great candidate as the poster particle for what we have done in this course. They remind me of pure depth, of flesh, of seduction, and the many other homologous primitives that we know and can experience, yet are not actually graspable by our efforts. The human body, we have learned, is the locus for a great many systems that operate at lightning speed based on physical processes so complicated and so remarkable that we can only share Professor Gorham's analogy of being humbled by the task of trying to measure or comprehend them. Recall the descriptions of the complexity of the brain. The brain is composed of neurons or nerve cells, which are the nervous system's basic functional units. We are born with over 100 billion neurons. Each neuron has a cell body and tens of thousands of branches called dendrites, which receive information from other neurons. Each neuron also has a primary axon that can travel long distances in the brain that sends data out of the cell to communicate with other cells. When neurons communicate with other neurons, the points of contact are called synapses. Each neuron makes up to 10,000 synapses with other neurons. Ramachandran wrote, "A piece of your brain the size of a grain of sand would contain 100,000 neurons, 2 million axons, and 1 billion synapses all talking to each other." Try to comprehend the billions of synapses that are constantly fired just to keep our bodies in quotidian operation. Now consider how many more are involved in the simplest thought or memory or feeling. Remember the proprioceptive system where measurable interceptors in the muscles and joints communicate and translate in feedback and feed forward loops impossible amounts of information, all essential to accomplish basic human movement. Recall Candace Pert's discussion of the chemistry of emotion and how our simplest feelings are based on vast chemical processes where ligands, a variety of small molecules, bind to cellular receptors, conveying information to the cells that results in our feeling emotion. These ligands travel and connect over great distances at blinding speeds. Higher operations like the way we think, through blending processes, metaphor construction and use, hypothetic inference, and the intricacies of language use all required systems of trillions of elements operating and functioning at blinding speeds. The entire system of perception, we have learned, is not a simple unidirectional data collection operation, as impressive as even that would be. Rather, we understand perception as an amazingly interactive process created through sensory motor patterns, basic body neurobiology, and proprioceptive dispositions that we arrive with in the world. And were this catalog of processes not enough to awe us, we must recognize that these are not parallel systems, each operating independently. Rather, they are all in communication and coordination with one another to support us as human beings in a remarkably smooth way. All of these processes are known to us, measurable, detectable. We have read so many studies to support this. Yet we seem to be built so that we cannot be aware of all these processes in ourselves. To account for what we know, yet cannot grasp, we have invented images and schemas that capture traces that inspire us to imagine. Beyond that, we share Gorham's knowledge that what we are about is like measuring the spirit world. I have been frankly surprised that movement has emerged as fundamental in our every consideration. I can't get out of my mind the image of the kitties pulling other kitties around in carts without the experience of self-actuated movement experiences. The riding kitties were functionally blind. So too with us across the full range of what distinguishes us as human beings. We are moving creatures, and our sense of self and other, of perception and depth, and feeling and form all arise through the bumbling explorations of our own self-actuated moving bodies. The implications of this awareness and appreciation have, for me, come to two primary focal concerns: academic lifestyle and the role of dancing in human development and culture. While I have long reflected on what I have believed to be the deleterious impact of sedentary occupational lifestyle on academic work, and particularly the habituation of our primarily Christian forefathers, I still avoided saying anything about it. However, with increased appreciation of the enormous role movement plays in every aspect of our thinking, imagining, acting, and knowing, I am finally finding it necessary to explore the likely limitations of the profession and field we represent. It can no longer sound silly to beseech you, the oncoming generation, to reinvent the academy in terms of movement. I am not at all sure what that will look like, but I firmly believe that the impact of this revolution will be the complete reinvention of what we study and how we go about it, that the resulting studies will be more engaging and relevant and connected with the full spectrum of religious life. And I firmly believe that without this revolution, our studies and perhaps the academy itself will not survive. Then, too, I have been a long-time student of dancing. Since dancing plays such a minor, even negative role in our society, I have been hesitant to actually tout dancing despite all that I have come to appreciate about it. Again, my time of silence has come to an end. Dancing, as I am coming to understand it, holds an exemplary place in our many discussions. Dancing as a quotidian and near universal human experience holds immense potential for enhancing and exploring many topics: flesh, metaphor, seduction, aura, body, brain. Dancing in most cultures is nearly synonymous with religion and culture. I now feel a responsibility to realize and articulate this potential as fully as I can. One of the most powerful moments for me during our studies has been a fuller grasping of the notion of pure depth, and this increase in insight supported a better understanding of flesh, reversibility, chiasm, seduction, and so on. Recall that depth involves that dimension by which we see something from here that is at its place there. The here and there are contemporary in our experience. They are joined in time through their visibility, and this is depth, a space of co-present implication. Depth is that dimension that contemporaneously unites and separates. It is a thick view of time, the most existential dimension. We came to understand the dimension depth itself in terms of pure depth, a depth without distance from here, a primordial that does not yet operate between objects. Merleau-Ponty used Eugene Minkowski's dark space to give some sense of the experience of pure depth. Pure depth is without foreground or background, without surfaces, and without any distances separating it from me. Pure depth is always already there as the formative medium of the subject and object, as the inauguration of the where and when. The moving body is fundamental to flesh, because through movement, flesh begins to understand itself and become aware of itself. When I experienced Professor Gorham's efforts to even describe neutrinos, I caught reflections of pure depth. Neutrinos were already there in the beginning, necessary for the kinetic construction of the elements. Thus, they are pre-elemental. They continue to persist, virtually undetectable by us, as ambient to the universe. They oscillate, they are paired. Seductively, they do nothing, yet they make everything possible. They may well share the same descriptors given pure depth, the depth of our being and the true source of our life, yet framed at once by subatomic and cosmic processes. While Merleau-Ponty understood flesh as the ultimate truth, this statement gains depth for me in grasping the homology with a subatomic counterpart, neutrinos, which we might see as comprising the flesh of the cosmos. The universe within echoes the universe without. Many years ago, I wrote a paper titled "Go Up Into the Gaps, the Play of Native American Religions." I'm not at all sure that I got around to publishing it. I don't really remember. I do recall giving it as a lecture in Canada at my friend Tom Parkhill's invitation. It was about my experience studying Native American religions. I used Frederick Schiller's understanding of play as presented in his book On the Aesthetic Education of Man, published in 1793, to develop our understanding of masking and ritual in Zuni and Navajo examples. Schiller understood play as arising from the reciprocal interaction between two interdependent yet separate drives. He argued that when these two drives interact in concert in an oscillatory manner, a third drive arises. He called this third drive play and identified it with beauty. Surely this is an early articulation of the structurality that we have been exploring in so many arenas this semester. Play occurs in the gaps between structural elements. I considered Native American religions, particularly masking, the interplay between mask and masker in terms of Schiller's understanding of play. A quick aside. Charles Sanders Peirce, the father of pragmatism, had a common structure to the many explorations throughout his life's work. This, too, focused on the identification of a third thing when we consider the effect of two interacting, interdependent, paired things. The third thing was invariably the energetic, driving, fueling force behind the other two, the structurality that precedes and is essential for the existence of the two more readily recognized by us than the hidden third thing. For example, we all know the pairing of induction and deduction as the principal inferential methods of science. But Peirce proposed a third hidden thing, which he termed abduction. Abduction is that oscillatory, iterative process initiated by the feelings of surprise that is based on reason, he argues, that leads to an almost instant best guess, which we then identify as a hypothesis. Familiarly, we all experience this process, yet the actual awareness of the process in action is hidden from us. Peirce spent several months as a teenager carefully studying Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man. Peirce celebrated the gaps, as did Schiller. Throughout this course, I've been thinking of the gaps that are fundamental to our existence. There is the synaptic gap between neurons. The entire operation of our brain takes place in these gaps. How remarkable that we speak so casually of synaptic firings, of brain wiring, of brain functioning, when it all takes place rather mysteriously in the synaptic gaps and the spaces between. When we have attempted to grasp Merleau-Ponty's flesh ontology, perhaps the most important points for me in catching a glimpse of this ontology are the notions of chiasm and the incomplete reversibility. Chiasm is a crossing place, that hidden dark space where reversibility occurs, a free space of structure, a space without objects, a gap. Reversibility is the interconnection between things, yet complete reversibility would indicate the identity between paired elements. In such an interrelationship, there is no life, no movement, no action, no meaning, because there is no difference to feel the oscillation. The life of reversibility, its potential to create meaning, is then the knot in the interrelationship, that condition that wedges space between the pairing. This knot is what creates the gap of play. It is in the gap, the chiasm, that incomplete reversibility becomes vitality. Then there is metaphor. Because I have become a believer in the powers of gaps, I can't accept the established understanding of metaphor as comprised of unidirectional mapping from the concrete to the abstract. There is no play, no seduction in this structure. I propose that we must see metaphor as an incomplete reversibility, as knowing something in terms of something else, which it is not. Following this proposal, we find metaphor as other than a process terminating in moving from one known thing to an unknown, but rather as a resonant, oscillatory structurality, much like perception, that functions to give us a program to embrace and comprehend our thoroughly bodied experience. In my paper, Go Up Into the Gaps, I quoted a passage from Annie Dillard's book, Tinker at Pilgrim Creek. It had been the inspiration for my title. I'm pleasantly surprised, these many years later, that I am still contemplating the gaps. Here is what Dillard wrote. Ezekiel excoriates false prophets as those who have not gone up into the gaps. The gaps are the thing. The gaps are the Spirit's one home, the altitudes and latitudes so dazzlingly spare and clean that the Spirit can discover itself for the first time like a once blind man unbound. The gaps are the clefts in the rock where you cower to see the back parts of God. They are the fissures between mountains and cells the wind lances through, the icy narrowing fjords splitting the cliffs of mystery. Go up into the gaps. If you can find them, they shift and vanish too. Stalk the gaps, squeak into a gap in the soil, turn and unlock, more than a maple, a universe. This is how you spend this afternoon and tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. Spend the afternoon. You can't take it with you. Were I a theologian, my theology would surely be shaped in the beautiful and provocative poetic terms of Dillard and Gorham. God is to be found when we go up into the gaps of synapse, of play, of hidden knots and nos, of chiasm, of seduction, of metaphor, of blending and flesh and dancing. God is to be found herding neutrinos. And in these gaps, awestruck by the prospect of what we imagine, we cower there waiting, 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 waiting for God to flesh us her backside. To be mooned by God, this is enlightenment worth our wait. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.